It's good to be back this afternoon. One time, many, many years ago, Brother Bill Hall spent the night with us. That was even back before he married, so that's been many years ago. And on a Wednesday night, and our children were in school at the time, and we got up the next morning and we're getting them off to school, trying to be quiet to keep him from waking him, and he woke up anyway, and he came down the hall, feeling each side of the hall, and I think trying to make his way to the bathroom. But he said, "You know, it doesn't take long to stay all night here." Well, it doesn't take long to spend the afternoon with the Rouses when you have service at 3 o'clock. And but I'm glad to be back for this afternoon service. We started this morning and talking about one aspect of this marriage and divorce situation. And I said that this afternoon we deal with the second question that was dealt with in this discussion that we had. And that is, are civil marriages and divorces irrelevant to real marriages and divorces? Before I do that, I want to mention one other aspect of our study this morning. When we're talking about the divorce for any cause, usually when we're talking about that, a number of situations are presented to us by people where there's a wife or sometimes even a husband that may be very abusive, and the wife or the husband is in a very abused situation. And we ask then, what about that? Since they're in that abusive situation, then does the abused wife, and usually situation presented to us like this, that her life and the lives of her children are in danger because of this abusive husband, and therefore are you telling me that there's no relief, that she cannot divorce that man and get relief from that situation? And it's a very emotional line, a very emotional thing. I have two things to say about that. Number one is this, that emotional situations extreme situations like that doesn't mitigate against what is said in the scriptures about one cause for divorce. But the second thing that I say about that is that there's a possibility to get relief, possibility of getting protection from physical harm and physical abuse short of getting a divorce. Usually when they present that situation, they present it to you in such a context as to try to make it appear that the only relief, the only alternative that person has, only two alternatives, is to stay in that abusive situation, risk the lives of themselves and their children, or to divorce and get out of the situation. And it's usually said, after all, that in the first century, a lot of the legal things that are available now were not available then. And that's the only choices they had then. Well, in the first place, that's an assumption. That's the only relief they had back then, was either divorce or stay in the situation. But even granted that that's so, now there are reliefs that can be had, but there is a principle that's taught in the scriptures that gives the Christian, and I believe that's any Christian, the right to use the powers that be for physical protection. Paul did in Acts chapter 23. And you can begin reading about verse 16 and read through the rest of the chapter. I'm not taking the time to read that because I want to get on to this other question. But you read through that where Paul was in his life was threatened, and he was persecuted for the cause of Christ. Life was threatened, and he there was a plot to kill him, and a relative of his found out that that was the plot to kill him. So he had the relative to go to the Roman authorities and make it known unto them so that they could protect Paul from this plot to kill him. And it really wound up with this situation. It really wound up that later on Paul had to even appeal to Caesar in order to get relief from the persecution. And the point I'm making is that there is biblical precedent for a Christian to appeal to the authorities to get relief from physical harm by using those authorities. Now, in the case of a marriage situation, where if it gets to that extreme situation, yes, I believe that this woman, in that situation, she can get a restraining order. I believe, use the powers that be, get a restraining order against that abusive husband, always with a view of trying to get him to straighten up, to get him to reverse his action, and be restored then, and come back and be the kind of husband he ought to be. And some brethren disagree with me on this one, but I believe that there's the device of a legal separation that's available to them. The legal separation is gives the woman who's abused, gives her all the protection that a divorce would as far as property and custody and all that's concerned, but it stops short of ending the marriage. It leaves it open for reconciliation, where that should he change and should his attitude change, and that's the should be her objective always, that should that attitude change, then they can resume the marriage. She has not put an end to the marriage. She has not put a period to the marriage. It is still open, and still a marriage, and still open for reconciliation. So there are legal ways that one can get relief short of and without getting a divorce. And to argue that maybe, say, legal separation was not available in the first century. Well, that may be true. I don't know. But it's available now. And one can use it under the principle that use whatever means available to you to avoid physical harm and physical death if necessary. That's about like saying the fellow can't use an automobile because it wasn't available in the first century to go preach the gospel. Well, we know he can, but I believe that one can use whatever means available to them short of, now let me emphasize that, short of ending the marriage, short of putting a period on the marriage by divorce. They can use whatever means is necessary in order to get that relief. I want to throw that in before we left the matter of divorce for any reason. Now, let's talk about the matter of the civil aspects of the marriage. And give a little bit of background as to what this is all about. The idea is that civil government, the civil powers, that the marriage, the civil marriage or the civil divorce, is really irrelevant to the real marriage and the real divorce in God's eyes. For example, a person goes to the courthouse, it gets a marriage license, they get married, that is only to satisfy civil law. But it is irrelevant to whether or not they're really married, because in order to be really married, that marriage has to be recognized by God as being a lawful and scriptural marriage. And it's not really a marriage unless that's so. And consequently, if one goes down to the courthouse and gets a divorce, then that courthouse divorce is irrelevant to a real divorce, because it can only be a real divorce if it's a divorce that God approves. And thus, God, as they say, in God's sight, or as God approves. And when they say in God's sight, they don't mean by that in the sight of God that God doesn't know that person went down to the courthouse and got a divorce. But in God's sight, they mean it's God approved. And it's not really a divorce unless God approves of it. So whatever takes place in a civil marriage, a civil ceremony, a civil marriage, whatever takes place there, is completely irrelevant to whether or not that person, those persons are really married. And on the second, on the other end of it, if the fact they go down to the courthouse, file the papers, go through the process, get the divorce finalized, all that's irrelevant as to whether or not there has really been a divorce. And part of the reason for all that is, here's a fellow, he goes down, they man and his wife, they get into it, and this man, he files for divorce. He files divorce on whatever grounds, and he puts away his wife, and she doesn't particularly want to be put away. So he puts her away, he divorces her. Well, since that was only at the courthouse, and only a civil divorce, then it really was not a divorce in the eyes of God. So this later on, sometime 10, 15, or maybe 60, God forbid, 70 years ago, whatever number of years passed by, it doesn't matter. That was not really a divorce there. Then if that 5, 10 years later, that man commits adultery, then there has not really been a divorce. That's when I say commits adultery, he goes and gets married again. There's not really been a divorce. So now this woman can divorce him in her mind by repudiating that marriage and procure the divorce, because there never has been a real divorce to begin with. Now that's the whole idea of it. And that's the way it works in the minds of those who take that position. I want to show, try to show a number of things wrong with that position as we talk about it this afternoon. In order also to get a background of it, for many years, and I think rightly so, we have preached that basically that God has three ordained institutions. There's the church, there's the home, or marriage, and there's the government, the state or the government, the civil government, all ordained of God. And we preach that, and I believe that's so, that there are those three divine institutions. That is, in the sense that they were divinely ordained of God and instituted by God Himself. Now, in those three institutions, the first one is the, we'll talk about the church for just a minute. It is spiritual, as a kingdom of God. It is spiritual and eternal in nature. And God, in dealing with the church, is very explicit, specific and explicit as to what the church can do and how to do it and so forth and so on. And so God's very detailed in what He tells the church to do. Now the second two ordained of God, all right enough, but they are temporal. And not only temporal, but they're social in nature. The marriage relationship is a temporal relationship. It was not intended to be eternal. In heaven, there's neither married nor given in marriage. So marriage is a social institution that God has instituted for the good of man while he lives here upon this earth, and for the orderliness of man and society here on this earth. There's the civil government, which is ordained of God. And according to Romans chapter 13, not only ordained of God, but if we resist the ordinance of the civil government, we resist the ordinance of God, according to that passage. And so it's ordained, but it also is social and temporal in nature. It is for life here on this earth only. It's not to transcend this world. And thus it is a temporal social organization, or institution rather, instituted and ordained of God. Marriage the same way. It's a social institution, instituted, ordained of God. Both of them are for man's benefit while he lives on earth, in order to prevent social chaos in this world while we live here. Now, as been proven through the centuries, if when there's a breakdown in the marriage institution, a marriage relationship, or a breakdown in the civil institutions, chaos results. The order goes to pot, so to speak, when there's a breakdown in either one of them. Now, having said that in the background, I want to point this out as well. While God instituted both of these, He did not necessarily spell out the details of what they were to be in each society or each age of the world. The government, for instance. While civil government is ordained of God, while we are to obey the civil government, and while disobedience to it is its ordinances are tantamount to disobedience to God's ordinance, with the one exception, if the civil government demands of us something that conflicts with the higher authority of God. But anyway, but that being so, God has not specified in any of this as to what form that civil government is to take in each age, in each society. I happen to like the American form pretty good. I think it's the best that man has ever come up with as far as the form of government is concerned. But if a person is living and a citizen of Russia, Saudi Arabia, Israel, Japan, he still, as a Christian, he still has the obligation to obey that government no matter what the form is. But God left it up to the society, each society, to decide what form of government it should take. Now, in this country, they've decided on the democratic form because they were fed up with England and its autocratic form. And I like it. It's a great form. But it's not the only form that is on earth. And that's not the only form that's ordained of God. That maybe comes to shocking to some Americans. But it's not the only form that's ordained of God. Because God did not specify the form of government. He left it to each society to work that out. That was great. Likewise, on the marriage problem. While God, in the beginning, defined and instituted marriage as to what it is, what the basic form of marriage is, in other words. When He said back in Genesis chapter 2, you know, if you go back to 1 and 2 and you read about the creation, and then you read about Him creating the man and the woman, male and female created them, and how He brought them together, and then how that He ordained that a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. Now, here God defines what marriage is as well as instituting. It is a union. As the modern dictionary says, in the English dictionary I have, is a legal union between a man and a woman. As husband, recognized as husband and wife. Now, God, back in the beginning, defined who was to get married, a man and a woman. It was, you know, somebody said Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. They were to be married. He defined that and instituted the marriage institution with those words in Genesis 2 and 24. Jesus appealed back to them when He said in Matthew chapter 9, answering the question of the Pharisees, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? He appeals back to that. But having said that, then what is it then that constitutes marriage? That is, what is it that ratifies or makes that marriage a legal arrangement? What makes that marriage a real entity? God did not specify the arrangements or the procedures that one had to follow in order to solemnize that marriage, in order to make it a covenant between the two. He did say in Malachi that it's a covenant, and a covenant is, of course, agreement between the two parties, But it's more than that. It is something that has to be ratified. As in Galatians chapter 3, and I believe it's verse 15, he makes it clear that a covenant is not enforced unless it is, he says in that passage, unless it is confirmed. The word confirmed there is from a word which means to ratify. And in order for a covenant to be binding, it's not only is there an agreement, but there is a ratification of that agreement. Now, how is this, in marriage is a covenant, and God ordained it in the beginning. How then is this covenant to be ratified in order for it to take place? God didn't say in the beginning. He did not say. Therefore, it was left to each society to have its method of ratifying covenants. And that would include the marriage covenant. Now, if you read through the Old Testament, there were various covenants for different reasons, but always they were openly and publicly ratified in such a way that the people involved and the society in which they made their pledge in the covenant, so that they would recognize that a covenant had been made and a covenant had taken place. That was throughout. That was forms of ratification. Sometimes it had to do with cutting an animal in two and passing it through the people. Sometimes there's other ways of it. Sometimes the marriage covenant was ratified by marriage feast. Sometimes the marriage covenant was ratified by the formality of the man taking his wife, present it to her new husband, and let it be known that this marriage was now officially ratified, was an official thing. And there are other ways. And some of the primitive societies, even in this country, I understand, that was, especially in slave-holding areas among black people, it was ratified by jumping the broom. As a ceremony, though, of broom jumping, and that ratified the covenant. But it was something that was publicly and openly ratified. And God did not specify, any more than did in the government situation, God did not specify exactly what procedure you would go through in order to ratify this covenant. And for that reason, when you read in the scriptures from beginning to end, you read of people being married, given in marriage, sometimes just simply says he took a wife, and all those things. And sometimes it's said without anything being said about what procedure they went through to do that. Other times, it is shown what procedure they went through. But when you look at that, it was not necessarily the same procedure in each particular society. And so it leaves us with this, that God, while he ordained marriage to begin with, and he defined it as a union between a man and a woman, he did not specify the means by which that covenant would be ratified for every society. So each society is left to itself to figure out a means by which it shall be ratified. Now, in our society, in this country, for example, is ratified by a couple making the decision, making the agreement, that's part of the covenant, to be married, and then they ratify it in a public kind of way. And the way they do that is they go down to the courthouse, they get a license, and that license requires that some official, religious or civil, that some official, as they say, solemnize the marriage with ceremony. And then the license is presented back to the courthouse and is put on file. All of that is involved in the ratification of this covenant. And until that covenant is ratified, it's not in force. And so it's not a marriage until that takes place. I was in Kentucky a few years ago in a gospel meeting, and there was a couple, they told me about the week before, come down out of the hills to the courthouse, and they were going to get married. And so they went to the circuit court's office and got their marriage license. And then next week, the circuit clerk saw the mother of the bride and said, listen, he said, how the newlyweds get along? Did they get married all right? She said, you ought to know, you did it. He said, I didn't do anything but sell them the license. Said that they, and they thought that's all they had to do. And they were in Cincinnati on the honeymoon. Well, what they had to do, they had to send back to Cincinnati, get them back down there and go through the procedure in order to be recognized as marriage, go through the ceremony and have the license signed by the official. And then, when they did that, they were married. That's the procedure we have now. Other countries and other societies may have other procedures. And societies in the past may have had other procedures. And to bring up examples like is often done, for instance, Abel. When Abel got married, what courthouse did he go to? When Joseph got married down in Egypt, what courthouse did he go to? When Jacob, you know, he went over to Laban, got the two wives. He got one outright for working for her 7 years, another on the installment plan for working another 7 years for the second wife. And in each of those cases, what court did they go to? What courthouse did they go to? And that's brought up several times. No, I say this. They went through whatever procedure that their society dictated in order to recognize them as married. And that's how they married. In the case of Herod, the Bible said, doesn't say he allegedly married her, or he might have married her. He said that Herod had his brother's wife, and says, for he had married her. Not that he'd allegedly married her, not that he had accommodatively speaking married her, but he, inspiration says, he had married her. So, having married her in Mark 6:17, what procedure did he go through to marry? I don't know. I don't know. But I know this, that they were recognized as married in the society in which they lived. They were recognized as such. And so he had married her. Now, these fellows, some of them, and I don't want to paint them with too wide a brush, but some of them, and the one I was discussing this with, they readily admit that the civil aspect of marriage and the civil aspect of divorce has nothing to do with reality of the situation. That all it does is just satisfy the courts of the land. And we are under obligation to obey the laws of the land. Since we are, we'll go have it recorded. But it has nothing to do with whether or not they were really married or they were not really married. And what it boils down to is the only way that you can know that a couple is married for sure is go talk to them. Here's a couple moving the street across from in on your street, and they are over there, and you begin to are they married? They find no record of it. Find no record of where they've ever been married. Well, you begin to wonder, and you begin to talk to them, and you begin, and they get into the Lord's church. You bring them down, you talk to them, and you confess them they need to be baptized. Well, then you begin to think a minute, well now, you folks are married, aren't you? Yes, we're married because we committed ourselves to each other in such and such date, such and such hour, under the apple tree at such and such place. Before God, we pledged ourselves to each other, and therefore we're married. No civil ceremony. Nothing of the kind like that. Well, all in the world you've got there to say that they're married is they claim to be married. Because they place themselves to each other. before God without any civil things involved at all. In fact, this is a real case that happened not too long ago. Happened there where my grandson preaches in Pleasant Grove. This lady, they told her she'd remarried, and she was a widow. She'd been married for about a year. And they got to talking to her about it, and really, they'd never been anywhere to get married. What they did, this one night, they decided they were going to get married, and they placed themselves to each other. And they'd been operating under that for about a year. And the brethren found out about it, and they had to deal with it. But if you bypass civil law, why weren't they married? Why not accept them as married? After all, they said they were married. After all, they placed each other privately. Let me show you where that thing will lead further. Here's a young couple out on a Saturday night. Now, be as explicit I think I can and be still modest with it. They're out on a Saturday night in the back seat of the car, and the passion gets high. And both of them believe that you should not engage in sexual activity outside of marriage. So they say, well, we'll just get married. So they place themselves to each other and before God in the back seat of that car, and they're married. So what takes place the rest of the evening is legitimate. After all, civil power has nothing to do with it. Not at all. Not at all. Well, they over the weekend, and the passion cools down, they say, uh-oh, we made a mistake. Well, okay, that's all right, too. We'll just unpledge ourselves to each other and get a divorce. Oh, no, that marriage, after all. So we were married. What we did in the meantime was legitimate. But we decided we made a mistake, so we're going to get the divorce here. And we don't have to go to civil authority. Therefore, we can have a middle divorce. And they do that over and over and over again. And be married and not married according to their own whims. If civil powers are not involved. Now, let's look at it a little further. Neither a marriage covenant nor its nullification is a private mental act. It is something that's done, can be publicly verified and ratified by a public record. Much of the marrying and giving in marriage are taken of wives. As I said, I had no specific procedure. But it says Herod had married her. Now, this distinction that some are making between that which is a real marriage or divorce and an apparent marriage divorce is not a biblical distinction. See, here's the couple. They divorce according to the law of the land. But since it was not a scripture divorce, it was not a real divorce. It was only apparent divorce. And so it boils down to the fact then that there are real divorces, those that God approves. There are apparent divorces, ones that God do not approve. There are real marriages, ones that God approves. And then there are apparent marriages, the ones God doesn't approve. So when you're reading in the scripture about so-and-so got married, you have to wonder whether that was a real or apparent. And when you read of a divorce, you have to wonder if it's real or apparent. The Bible just doesn't make those distinctions. That's a modern invention. When the Bible says they were married, they were married. They might not have been lawfully married in the sense that it was not lawful for Herod to have her, but they were married. The only distinction made in the scriptures are the lawful or unlawful marriages. But they're marriages. And divorces are either lawful or unlawful. But their divorce is not the same. And so, whosoever divorces his wife and marries another, it's not apparently divorced. But whosoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries her that is put away, that's a real marriage. It's not an apparent marriage. married her, that's put away, commits adultery. It's not a parent, allegedly, or anything of the kind. There's marriage, there's divorce in the scriptures. And those marriage and divorce take place when they are ratified by the government or by the civil authority under which we live. And the Bible recognizes them as real. Now, let me point this one other thing out. Matthew 19:9, it is really a joke if this idea is true. And it makes it impossible to apply Matthew 19:9 if this idea is true. Let me show you what I'm talking about. Matthew 19:9 says, whosoever shall put away his wife, other version says, whosoever shall divorce his wife except for fornication. But wait, hold it. If he divorces her for reason of fornication, God doesn't approve of it, therefore it's not a real divorce. Therefore he didn't divorce her because it's not real if it was not for fornication. The only divorce can be real in that passage, according to them, is the one that would be for fornication. But if he divorced her for reason other than fornication, it's not real. So whosoever divorces his wife, except for fornication, and marries another, but wait, that marriage is not real either. Because it's not a God-approved marriage. And it's not a God-approved marriage, it's not a real marriage. So when Jesus said he marries another, he's saying that which is impossible, he can't do it in God's eyes. He can't do it because God does not accept that marriage, therefore it's not real. So we have Jesus saying, whosoever shall put away his wife, or whosoever shall divorce his wife, but not really, because he can't do that, and marries her, but not really, because he can't do that, because that's illegal, committeth adultery. And he that marries her, but not really, because he can't do that, and God doesn't approve of it, therefore it's not a real marriage, committed adultery. So how do you find Matthew 19:9? Because it can't be done in God's eyes, in God's sight, if that's true. Because whosoever should put away his wife, that's not a real divorce if it's not for fornication. And who that marries her that is put away, that's not a real marriage, because God doesn't approve of that marriage. And one marries the other, it's not a real marriage, because God doesn't approve of that marriage. So you've got Jesus speaking in riddles, really. It's a joke of it. When he says, whosoever shall put away his wife, but woe it, Lord, you can't do that. That's not real. Marry her, woe it, Lord, you can't do that. That's not real. And he that married her, but woe it, wait a minute, Lord, you can't do that either. Because that's not real either. So you have Jesus saying, if one does that which he cannot do, and another does that which he cannot do, and another does what he cannot do, then you've got this situation. It just don't work out. It won't work that way. Those marriages he talks about are real marriages. They're real divorces. But they're not approved of God. And that's the difference. So that they're real, none the same. So that brings us back to the general application that started this whole society. This whole discussion of society and government. Here's a couple, and they get married, and he puts her away for frivolous reasons. She's really divorced, and he's really divorced. You can't have two divorces on the same case. He puts her away, they're really divorced. And he then, later on, he marries another, and he really marries her. Then, at that point, then the innocent party decides, now she can mentally put away him because he's now committed adultery. There's no question he's done that. She can now, in her mind, she can put him away for fornication and marry. But there's only one problem with that. You've got two divorces. You've got the divorce that's civil back here. You've got the mental divorce. You've got two put his way in the same case. Furthermore, you've got the one put away, that one which is already away. So how can you put one away who's already away? They've already been put away. It just won't work. So it may create a hardship, but sin does that sometimes, even on innocent people. And it may do that. But I can't set aside the law of God just because it may cause some hardship on some people. And a further thing, people assume that God means for every person to have a happy marriage no matter what. Where does the Bible say God intends that that should be so? He doesn't. He doesn't say that so. And so, what you have here is the marriage and a divorce, and later on a divorce of the same marriage. And the reason they say it is because God didn't recognize this first divorce, therefore it's not real. Yes, it was real. And you can't put away that which is already put away. You can't put asunder that which is already asunder. It's just that simple. Now, one other thing that we will note is government and society determines when and how a marriage takes place or divorce takes place. God ordained in the beginning there should be marriage and define what it is to be. I was accused in this discussion of saying that it was left up to government to define marriage. Therefore, if it defined homosexual marriages, then that would be all right to it. I didn't say that. I didn't say it was left up to government to define marriage. I said that God defined marriage in the beginning as a union between a man and a woman. What he left up to government was the procedure by which that marriage is ratified and takes place. That's the difference. And God regulates it to such extent that he tells who may lawfully take advantage of that procedure. That's it. Who may take advantage of that procedure. I cannot, if I don't have a right to remarry, I can't take advantage of the procedure to marry under any government. That's true any time. If I don't have a right to divorce, I may take advantage of that and divorce, but I don't have a right to, and therefore I will sin against God when I do. But I'll still be divorced when I do it, but it's just be an unlawful divorce. In other case, I would still be married, but be an unlawful marriage in that case. And so it's God is left up to determine when and how. But it's God, not God, but society, rather. He left up society to determine when and how a marriage divorce takes place. But God determines if it's lawful or unlawful. And that's where we are on the marriage and divorce problem. But to me, of all of the things that come up, this is one of the most dangerous of any of them. The reason it is, if it is put into practice literally as conceived by these folks, it will throw marriage and divorce into such chaos that we'll never be able to determine who is married, who is divorced, never be able to determine who has a right to marry, who has a right, not the right to marry, because it's all in chaos. Everything is left up to just a secret arrangement that takes place between people and God away from the eyes of society totally. And there's no way that society can recognize marriage and divorce and deal with it, because it's no longer a matter of society or civil powers. It's purely a matter, a private matter between people and their God. And all that the laws have to do with marriage, divorce, and in our society are completely irrelevant, if that's the case. and the whole thing's thrown in society. It puts it in a situation that it's, some preachers are going to get in trouble if they follow this thing. Here's a couple. They come to me for, want to know what about getting married. And I tell them, well, now listen. Don't you know that you don't? I don't have to have anything to do with it. The government don't have to have anything to do with it. What you two do, you go back home. You pledge yourself to each other before God, and you're married. You're married. And I give my blessing to you on that. And later on, they say, well, what about we want a divorce? Well, you decide that. You decide a divorce. You, in your mind, you decide to do it. You don't have to worry about society or government involved in that. That being the case, then what is going to happen is they're going to, government's going to, well, eventually going to get involved and get a hold of some preachers for giving that sort of advice of breaking the law in the states in which they live. And it just won't work. Won't work practically, and more especially, it won't work scripturally. Well, the lesson is yours. It may be that, again, that you were here this afternoon, you may need to obey the gospel of Christ, or maybe to be restored. If you accept the Lord's invitation anyway, you need to make things right with God, then you have an opportunity to do so while we stand, while we sing the song.